on the women of the Old Testament, and this week we're looking at two classical prophets with contemporary messages, Amos and Hosea. Today we're starting to look at Amos, and we'll look at Amos for the next two times also. So if you've haven't read the book of Amos for a while, you might want to take a look at it over the next couple of days. Just out of curiosity, how many of you have ever read the book of Amos in entirety? Good group of people. It's not always a prophet that we hear a lot about in the church. I thought that the title, which is taken actually right from the book of Amos, I am not a prophet, would be a good title for beginning to look at Amos. Amos distances himself from prophets. And so I thought that would be a good title for a talk that's going to look at the prophetic books in general, look at prophets in general, and then introduce Amos, his life and times.
You missed.
Were you aiming? What's that? Okay. The prophetic books. Let's look at two traditions. The Hebrew Bible, which is the Bible that we call the Old Testament, the private Bible that Christians call the Old Testament, is the Bible that's used by the Jewish people to this day. It consists of three different parts. In fact, I'm going to pass around this translation of the Old Testament or of the Hebrew Bible for you to look at, so you can see that I'm not just making this all up as I'm talking. So this is a Jewish Publication Society translation of the Old Testament. I'm going to be passing around. You can look at it. It has three different parts. One, the first is called the Torah, and that's the first five books of the Bible or of the Old Testament: Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. These five books were traditionally considered to be the work of Moses. He authored all of them. The last couple of centuries have seen a change toward that authorship, and it's seen more as a composite work. In the Jewish tradition, this is the most important part of the Hebrew Bible, the Hebrew Scriptures, and this is read every year in its entirety. So this has kind of a primacy of place. And actually, probably this collection of five books came into being around 400 BC or so. So it's the earliest of these three different collections to come into existence. The second subdivision is called the Nevi'im, or prophets. It's just a word that means prophets, Nevi'im. And there's two different groups of prophets, the former and the latter prophets. The former prophets, we don't actually usually consider them prophets. We have Joshua, Judges, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings. And then the latter prophets are those prophets that we would probably recognize as prophets. You have the three major prophets: Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and then 12 minor prophets that are put together all on one scroll. So this is the second division, and probably this came into formation around 200 BC or so. And then finally, the last division is the writings, or ketuvim. These are Hebrew, simply Hebrew words for ketuvim means writings. And this includes everything else: Psalms, Proverbs, Job, and a lot of little writings too. Now, since these are the three subdivisions of the Hebrew Bible, it's known as the Tanakh. And in fact, that's what this translation is called. On the front, if you look, it's called the Tanakh, because it's an acronym taking the T from Torah, or instruction, the N from Nevi'im, or prophets, and the K from Ketuvim, or writings. So the Tanakh is the Hebrew Bible. Now, when we look at the Christian Bible, there's a little difference in the organization of the books. Exactly the same books, especially if you look at a Protestant Bible without the Apocrypha in it. Now, actually, our Christian Bibles got their order, Christian Old Testaments, I should say, got their order from an ancient translation of the Hebrew original into Greek. And this started taking place around 250 BC or so, and this is known as the Septuagint. So in the Septuagint, this is a Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible done by the Jewish people in Egypt. You have a different order, and this is because the Greek mind likes to categorize more. And so actually you have more of a kind of a categorizing by genre or type of literature here. So what you have is you have the Pentateuch, the first five books. That's exactly the Torah. Then after that you have historical books. Not exactly historical in the way that we would think of history today, but more of a theologically interpreted history. God's always part of the story here. So this includes the former prophets, Joshua, Judges, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, but also includes a lot of the books that are in the Ketuvim in this section over here, books such as Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Ruth, and so forth, all put in this area. I should say, as far as date here, this section was still up for grabs as late as around 100 AD or so. People didn't know what was exactly in the Bible or out the Bible, even as late as 100 AD or so. If you look in Luke, the very last chapters of Luke, it says that Jesus fulfilled the law, prophets, and the Psalms. So it has this category here, the Torah, law, the prophets, and then it doesn't have this idea of the writings, but it just says the Psalms. There's still kind of a process of being shaped in this section here. Anyway, so the historical books continues the narrative of the Pentateuch. So you have kind of a logical progression in the Greek mind. You're going along with the story rather than having kind of a composition, the periods when these different groups were put together being the basis of organization. And then you have writings, Psalms, Proverbs, Job, and so forth. And finally, you have what we know as the prophets. These are the writing prophets, the latter prophets here, which incidentally includes Daniel, which is part of the Ketuvim over here. Now, this may seem pedantic or whatever, but what I want to point out is, though, while we both, the Jewish people, the Christian people, both share the same books of the Bible, as far as the Old Testament is concerned, there's this difference in order actually creates a difference in meaning also, which is kind of interesting. As I said, Torah, the first five books, are the most important, is the most important part in the Hebrew Bible in the Jewish community. For Christians, we would keep going, right? We'd say the Gospels probably were number one for us in our liturgy. We stand up when we read the Gospel and so forth, and that's always very prominent. And then, of course, Pauline letters, and then other things. So for us, say this part was the sort of the central part here. But if we were only to look at the Old Testament, I would say, looking at our lexicons and so forth, lexicons? At our list of readings.
Lectionaries.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Lectionaries. You have a lot of stuff from the prophets. So Christians really tend to emphasize the prophets. Also Psalms. Psalms are pretty big. But it's interesting, we have the same books and yet different emphasis. So although we have the same books, it's really sort of a different Bible in a way. And it's neat. The Christians have liked this order here with the prophets at the end because it's so handy. We've often used the prophets as kind of material that foretells the coming of Christ and tells the significance of Christ and so forth. And it's really handy. These books here are right in front of the Gospels. And if you take your Bible and look at the last prophetic book, and the last couple of verses in it, you all found it, Malachi. It says, "Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the great and terrible day of the Lord comes. And he will turn the hearts of fathers to their children and the hearts of children to their fathers, lest I come and smite the land with a curse." So you have this section here, the prophets in with the coming of Elijah. And then in the Christian Bible, Bible, all you have to do is just turn the page. And it's handy, and there you are, in Matthew. And Matthew is the gospel that really delights in picking up a lot of the words of the prophets and showing how Jesus fulfilled all of them. So I think it's very interesting to just notice that different order and also the different use of the prophets between the Jewish and the Christian faiths. Now, for this particular study, I've chosen two prophets that aren't used very much to foretell the coming of Christ or things like that. Amos and Hosea are not used as much as, for example, Isaiah in a kind of Christological way. And so I've chosen these two books so that we can really look at the classical prophets and look at them in their time setting and see who they really are themselves and not get too wrapped up in the Christian use of the prophets to predict the coming of Jesus and Jesus' function and so forth. Does anybody have any questions or comments about this material this far?
Question. Mm-hmm. How closely do the Torah and our Old Testament jive?
Mm-hmm.
Are there differences in the translations, which I guess came from the same source?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, of course, we've got several versions ourselves, but let's say, how different is it from the King James Version?
Mm-hmm. All this material here, well, okay, I should make one qualification. The Septuagint, in Egypt, the Jews translated this material, and some of the material, for example, the writings and some of the other books, they translated very loosely and, in fact, even added extra material. For example, in the book of Esther, the book of Esther never mentions the name of God once. And so in Egypt, people probably thought, well, this is kind of strange, you know? You wonder what Esther prayed, you know, how she prayed or whatever. So they inserted actually material. So you do have things that are inserted in this, but Luther kind of got this stuff out, the Apocrypha out, and put it in the middle, left it in the Bible, which is kind of interesting because most Protestant Bibles don't have the Apocrypha in them anymore. Luther retained it, he just didn't leave it within the body of the text there. So with that exception, that there is additional material in here, the books are exactly the same. And if you begin with the Hebrew Bible, you're beginning with exactly the same source too. So translational differences will occur. It would be interesting for some of you, you could look at that Jewish Publication Society translation, maybe look at a couple of key verses and see how they would translate.
Amos seems to be almost the same. I read the first couple of chapters.
Mm-hmm. About the same. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So basically, there's not going to be very much difference, except that there may be some slight differences where there's some leeway in interpretation in one group. You always interpret towards your own beliefs, you know, where you can. And so there might be some slight difference, but virtually the same. Any other questions, comments?
Now, when they located or found the Dead Sea Scrolls there, what mm-hmm. you seem to know, what parts of the Torah or the books of the Old Testament did they recover or find?
Mm-hmm.
Were they just portions of the Old Testament?
Mm-hmm. They found entire books. In some cases, for example, Isaiah, the book of Isaiah was very popular there apparently because they have whole scrolls, well-preserved whole scrolls. They found fragments of every book of the Old Testament except Esther. And some people have said that this is exactly because these writings were still in flux. You know, what exactly was canonical? What was normative? You know, what was central? What writings were central? And some people say, well, this Esther isn't found there, therefore Esther wasn't part of their canon. It wasn't part of their Bible. Well, you can also say they just didn't find any fragments, you know. Or you could also, there's another theory, and that is somebody said, this is a Jewish scholar, he said, well, I think it was Purim, which is the festival at which Esther is read. And so they had taken Esther out of the storage, and they were reading it. That's why they didn't find it. So, you know, what can improve from that, I don't know. But every book of the Hebrew Bible is found there except Esther. Fragments of every Bible, every book. Other questions, comments?
Why is it taking so long for the research results to be published on the material that was found in the Dead Sea?
Dead Sea Scrolls?
Is it political or?
Well, no, I think it's just greed. It was divvied up among different scholars, and people know kind of what's going to be published, and so other people have sort of studied and are ready to kind of pounce on that material and write really good articles, but the people who have the stuff, they want to write the definitive work. That's what it seems to me, anyway. Okay. Well, anyway, I just wanted to kind of place us here. We're going to be looking at Amos and Hosea, and those are two of the minor prophets, two of the 12 minor prophets. Okay, now we've talked a little bit about the prophetic corpus. We should probably talk a little bit about the word prophet itself. And actually, our English word comes from the Greek word prophetes. Prophetes, yeah, this is a little practice here, pi, rho, right? Prophetes. Okay, so prophet. I think I have something wrong here, there. Okay, prophet, prophetes means to speak, phetes means to speak, and pro sometimes means before, to speak before. So there is one sense of the word that means to predict the future. And there were oracles in Greece. People would go to certain sites and there would be seers. Oracles that would tell the future and so forth. So one meaning is to predict the future of this certain word. There's another meaning, though, that's a little better for our purposes, because although the prophets in the Old Testament do speak about the future, it's usually the very near future, and that doesn't seem to be their primary function. In fact, they kind of like to change the future. They want to change people's way of acting. So their primary role is not to predict, but another sense of this word, prophetes, means to speak for somebody. So to speak for as a messenger, or to deliver the word of. So that's a little bit better for our purposes, because the prophets in the Old Testament, they actually make known God's point of view in the world, make known God's presence and also God's point of view in the world. Kind of an interesting concept. We should go back a little farther and look at the Hebrew word here too, because this is simply a translation of the Hebrew word. They were trying to come up with the best Greek translation that they could of the Hebrew word. Navi means prophet. And this word seems to come from an Akkadian word. This Akkadian is another Semitic language. Navi in Akkadian comes from the root meaning to call, to call. Now Protestants get really excited about this word because we're really into vocation, you know, being called, having a vocation. And so one possible explanation of this word Navi means one who is called, one who has a call. Now some of the prophets have very famous calls. Isaiah, for example, in Isaiah 6, when King Uzziah dies, he sees this vision in the temple, and the glory of God fills the whole temple, and God's trains go all across the whole earth and so forth. And he's called, God's messengers say, who shall we send? Okay, so he's called in that way, and eventually after his lips are clean, he says, send me! So he goes. This is one possible explanation. There's also another meaning, though. If you take the active sense of it, instead of the one who is called, the prophet is also one who calls people. And it's very clear, the prophet is not just somebody who has some kind of inspiration, some kind of revelatory experience, and just lets it sit there. The prophet's one who somehow is in tune, in touch with God's pathos, with God's response, with God's will, and then communicates that also and calls the people to a way of life that's in accord with God's will. So I thought the prophets would be a good subject for study here at Holden Village, because our theme this summer is on earth as it is in heaven, and that implies the larger phrase, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And in the Old Testament, the prophets are those people that call exactly for that correspondence of the will of God on earth as in heaven. There's a sociological background to this whole concept of somebody going and calling, telling the will of another. In those ancient days before a telephone and TV and fax machines and all that kind of stuff, kings would send messengers, and they would go to different parts of the world, and they would speak the word of the king. They would say, thus says King blank of blank, if you don't do this, we're going to war. And they would speak with full authority of the king, because the king would have to stay in his capital, you know, way over here, and so the messenger would come to a different part of the world. And the prophets pick up on that kind of image, and often they say, thus says Yahweh, and then they deliver a message. So they pick on that up on that kind of sociological metaphor, I guess.
Kind of like a town crier.
Town crier, mm-hmm. Yeah. Some see it as a kind of a democratization of the whole thing, because usually the prophets speak to the whole people. Sometimes they speak to specific kings, but often they speak to the whole people, so they're telling the word of the king, which is God in this image, to the whole people. So it's kind of a democratization of the whole setup here, where you send messengers between kings, and the people become sort of in the place of another king on earth. We can ask the question of inspiration, you know. How do the prophets know what God is thinking or wanting? And one model is that, you know, they are just totally taken over and they sort of spit out whatever God wants them to say. And this is actually the model of the Quran. In the Quran, Muhammad is met by the angel Gabriel, and Gabriel recites passages, and Muhammad just repeats those, and so it's word by word. But in the prophets, if you look at the prophets, it's very interesting, because each prophet is so different in character that, you know, you wonder exactly at what level is the inspiration. You know, is it an idea, and then the prophets themselves write down their poetry? Because each prophet is so different in their poetic expression, and it is all poetry, which is an interesting thing to keep in mind. And also, it's interesting to note that the prophets aren't just receptive. If you look at Amos 7, for example, a little example here of what the prophet's consciousness is in these visions. These are a couple of visions here that Amos receives. It says, this is what the Lord God showed me. He was forming locusts at the time the latter growth began to sprout. It was latter growth after the king's mowings. But then, when they had finished eating the grass of the land, I said, O Lord, forgive, I beg you. How can Jacob stand? He is so small. The Lord relented concerning this. It shall not be, said the Lord. So he sees these visions of locusts devouring all the plants. And instead of just repeating this vision, he says, hey, no, wait a second. You know, Jacob, the people are so puny. How can they stand this? And so God says, okay. So the prophets are not only messengers of God, but also they are intercessors for the people too, which is kind of interesting. And apparently are always remain conscious during this kind of visionary experience, so they can reply back. Abraham Heschel, in his book on the prophets, talks about this whole idea of inspiration. And he talks about it in terms of event. There's some kind of event, we don't know what it is really, where God's pathos or feeling for the people is made clear to the prophets. And then this is responded to by the prophets in a kind of sympathy, where the prophets actually have sympathy for the divine point of view, which is radically different, usually, from human point of view. I mean, humans, okay, if the majority of people are well-fed and so forth, well, you know, okay, you have a few kind of problems, maybe a couple of homeless or whatever, but the divine point of view is enraged at this, that there would be any kind of even small deviations from a norm of justice. So the prophets, especially Amos is a good example to look at this, are always expressing the divine point of view. And Amos, we'll see, especially a lot of rage and anger expressed over deviating from justice. The Hebrew word for justice is mishpat. And justice is a good word for it, but it's always justice with compassion for the poorer people, for the helpless, for the weak, for the orphans, for the widows, for those who can't stand up for themselves. They should be taken care of. And if they're not, that's an affront, and it's an outrage from God's point of view. So through the prophets, then, we're able to glimpse just a bit what the divine point of view is. And maybe what we should do now is look a little closer at a specific prophet. And so we'll take a look at Amos. We'll need to quickly put him in his place, put him in his historical place. I wish I had a map, but I don't. Reading the superscription, or the first lines of Amos, we get a little bit of information about him. Now, this was written later, kind of to give the reader an idea who was writing here, or what these words were. The words of Amos, who was among the shepherds of Tekoa, which he saw concerning Israel in the days of King Uzziah of Judah, and in the days of King Jeroboam, son of Joash of Israel, 2 years before the earthquake. Remember the earthquake? It made quite a splash, apparently. And it, around 750 or so, it actually created a valley between the Mount of Olives and Mount Scopus. So if you go to Israel today, and you'll see there's a little dip there. And so that was the earthquake. So we have the words of Amos, who was among the shepherds of Tekoa. Okay, so it introduces him as a shepherd. Actually, there's a better word for shepherd than the one that the Hebrew uses here. It's boker, which actually, bakar means cow. So boker means a cowboy, really. He was among the cowboys. He owned cattle, apparently. It looks like kind of a humble image, but actually, later when we'll see, he describes himself. He says he's a noked, which means an owner of livestock also. That term, the noked, that's used later, is only it only appears in the Bible one other time, and that's to describe the king of Moab, Mesha, the king of Moab. So it's not necessarily a humble, rustic, peasant type. A lot of people have liked to see Amos as a fellow from sort of humble origins, because that way he could empathize more with the poor. That's kind of a romantic idea of him, that, you know, he was out there herding his sheep, and then he thought, hey, this is wrong, what's going on in the big cities, and so I've got to kind of get in there. But actually, according to the words that are here, he was not necessarily a poor man, but he just had an agricultural career. And according to Jewish tradition, this is kind of interesting, another kind of split, just to let you know that, the prophets were seen as being people who had their own livelihood, means of supporting themselves, because otherwise they would be corruptible. They would take bribes. They would be influenced by kings and so forth. So it's interesting, just two different traditions of interpretation. The Christians tend to say he was a less humble guy who could, you know, really appreciate and sympathize with the poor, and that's why he's talking the way he is about justice. And the Jewish tradition says, well, he probably had some money, because otherwise, you know, he could have been paid off.
I'm just curious, but why is it that so many, or it seems so many of the major and minor prophets come from areas outside of, let's say, Jerusalem?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it seems like they're from smaller communities.
Mm-hmm.
Is that because they were more in touch with God out there? Or?
Well, three of the prophets, three of the major prophets actually, Isaiah of Jerusalem and Jeremiah, he lived in Jerusalem. His family was from a little town, not both, but he actually lived in Jerusalem and did all of his prophesying in Jerusalem. And Ezekiel apparently was a priest in Jerusalem. So the major prophets seem to have been from Jerusalem. But you're right, in the minor prophets we do see a range of hometowns. Mm-hmm. Micah is from Moreshet, which is another small town to the southwest of Jerusalem, for example. Hosea seems to be from the northern kingdom and so forth. I don't know, I don't really have any. You seem to.
No. Thanks for elaborating.
Uh-huh. See, that would go along with that kind of romantic view of the prophets, you know, that they were kind of in the small town. They had more empathy for the poor because they're from the small town or something like that. And, you know, maybe. I don't know. Anyway, he is from a little town called Tekoa, which seems to be in the southern part of Judah, south of Jerusalem a bit. And I wish I had a map. I'm sorry, I don't. One problem with that people have pointed out is that these sycamore figs or whatever don't seem to grow in south of Jerusalem in that way. So some rabbis have said traditionally that he was from the north. But the dominant theory is that he was from the south, but he spent a lot of his time in Israel. And so maybe I should back up and just give you a very quick bird's eye view of history so you can place him in that context. The whole story of the Hebrew people starts with Abraham, of course, who's called from Haran up modern-day Syria down to Canaan. And it tells about the promise given to him for land, descendants, and blessing. His offspring end up in Egypt and eventually are enslaved there. So then, of course, you have Moses arising and you have the Exodus out of Egypt into the wilderness. And there, under Moses, the people receive the covenant and also the law at Mount Sinai. And then after wandering around for a while, you have the entry into the land of Canaan, the promised land under Joshua. And then you have a period of judges, kind of loosely united tribes living together, and apparently at sometimes charismatic leaders would arise in response, especially to adversaries outside of the tribes. Eventually, there was one group, the Philistines, the modern-day Palestinians. The Philistines living on the coast proved to be too difficult to challenge for the tribes, and so they began to unite to be stronger under Saul, first of all, and then under David. And David, King David, is seen as the great king because he united all of Israel, all the 12 tribes, and had the biggest expanse and so forth. And he was able to defeat the Philistines, actually, eventually. And so there was a period of safety and security there in the land. Now, Solomon follows, and he's seen as a very wealthy king and wise king, but also very oppressive, actually. And so soon after his death, his son Rehoboam went up to the northern tribes. David and Solomon were stationed in Jerusalem and more closely aligned with the south. So Rehoboam goes up to the north, and the northern tribes say, okay, we'll admit that you're our king if you'll lessen our load a little bit. And Rehoboam says, forget it. You know, my little finger is bigger than my dad's whole fist. And so the north says, well, that's it then. We're splitting. And so after that, there was a split of the two kingdoms. And the northern kingdom then was under a fellow named Jeroboam. And it was actually the larger portion. And the southern kingdom was just puny, comprised mostly of Judah. And during the history that follows, the split happened sometime in the around 922 or so BC. Israel is usually the stronger politically, militarily. So the northern kingdom is usually the stronger, and it's called Israel. The northern kingdom comes to be called Israel. The southern kingdom comes to be called Judah. And so here we have now Amos, who's from Tekoa, which is in the south, which is in Judah. And it says concerning Israel in the days of King Uzziah of Judah and of King Jeroboam II of Israel. It's very interesting. Here we have a southerner who apparently goes up to the north for quite a bit of his period of prophecy. And King Jeroboam II is named after King Jeroboam I. And this is a period of great economic prosperity in the north. This is the 8th century. Amos is living in the 8th century. And during Jeroboam II, you have a great period of economic revival. Looming over here, you have the Assyrian Empire that's coming in and meddling in things every once in a while and gets kicked off, kicked back by alliances and so forth. But during the 8th century, the Assyrian Empire is now busy in other parts, on other frontiers, and so you have a little bit of breathing space, and Jeroboam II is able to take back a lot of the land that was lost, and there's really a period of prosperity. And in this, it's very interesting, instead of seeing this as a sign of God's favor, Amos, in his cranky way, he's quite a character, really lashes out against all the powers that be, and he says, you know, there's affluence, but there's no justice whatsoever. And today I thought it would be interesting to look very briefly at a section in Amos, Amos 7, actually. This is the only biographical material, the only narrative material in Amos. And this tells about one of his trips up to the northern kingdom from the southern kingdom. You can imagine he would not be very well received. Right.
Must have took some boldness on his part. I mean, did he ever feel threatened in his life? He must have.
Yeah. Well, we'll read the only account that we have of him, and we can see what you can get out of that. He goes up, actually, to Bethel, which is in the north, and it's one of the main centers, religious centers, and also one of the places where the king hangs out, too. And he has this encounter with this priest named Amaziah. And so I'm just going to read this straight through, and you can see this classic kind of encounter between institutionalized power and this kind of charismatic figure here. Then Amaziah, the priest of Bethel, sent to King Jeroboam of Israel, saying, Amos has conspired against you in the very center of the house of Israel. The land is not able to bear all his words. For thus Amos has said, Jeroboam shall die by the sword, and Israel must go into exile away from his land. And Amaziah said to Amos, O seer, go flee away to the land of Judah. Earn your bread there and prophesy there, but never again prophesy at Bethel, for it is the king's sanctuary. It is a temple of the kingdom. Then Amos answered Amaziah, I am no prophet, nor a prophet's son, but I am a herdsman and a dresser of sycamore trees. And the Lord took me from following the flock, and the Lord said to me, go prophesy to my people Israel. Now therefore hear the word of the Lord. You say, do not prophesy against Israel, and do not preach against the house of Isaac. Therefore, thus says the Lord, your wife shall become a prostitute in the city, and your sons and daughters shall fall by the sword, and your land shall be parceled out by line. You yourself shall die in an unclean land, and Israel shall surely go into exile away from its land. Amos isn't exactly the kind of guy I'd like to have for my neighbor. His final words, your wife's going to be a prostitute. You're going to be going to exile, all your sons are going to be killed. Very nice. But anyway, here it's very interesting, this encounter. He is so bold as to go into Washington, D.C., go up to the White House, basically, you know, and burn the flag. We have in the prophetic tradition an amazing thing, actually. So much of people's mythologies are formulated to support the state, to support the power of institutions. If you look at the Babylonian mythology, the stuff that was around during this time period, Marduk, the king of the gods, created the world and established his temple in Babylon. There he lives in the center of the country, and he's created human beings to be his slaves. So all power of Babylon is legitimate power. There is no way to complain. There is no way to change anything. In the prophetic tradition, you have something that's quite different and really remarkable, and it actually gives rise to things like the civil rights movement, or to critique of governments in Central America, and liberation theology and so forth. And it's really a very amazing kind of tradition that we have. Really, I think, different if you look at other stories in the cultures of the world. Does anybody have reactions to this segment before we look at it a little more closely? No?
How was Amos treated then in the south, in Judah? Mm-hmm. I mean, here he was speaking out against the northern kingdom. He must have been pretty popular at home, though.
Mm-hmm.
Would he return to Judah, you know, after prophesying up north?
Mm-hmm. This is all we have. It's very cryptic, isn't it? We just have this, his appearance in the north, and Amaziah says, look, go south and earn your bread. Go earn your living there, saying these kinds of things.
Is it saying go back where you came from? Is it known that he's from the south?
This is one of the reasons why people think that he is from the south, and also because there is a place known as Tekoa, which is in the south. There's also a Tekoa in the north, though, so it gets kind of tricky. But because he says go back, and so these are some of the reasons why people think he is from the south.
Mm-hmm. Do my Jewish friends call this a lot of chutzpah?
A lot of chutzpah, right? Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of interesting. He says, I'm no prophet. And Amaziah says, go back to Judah, earn your bread there. Earn your living there as a prophet. Implying that prophets were actually kind of career prophets. They made their money as prophets. And he says, I am no prophet. Nor a prophet's son. So in a way, he's distancing himself from the whole thing, I think. We might ask then, you know, what is he trying to separate himself from? There is a long tradition of prophets, actually, even before the 8th century. So he's not coming out of the blue. But in the former prophets, we have stories of court prophets, for example. People that the kings employed to be kind of their cabinet members, and they would call on them and they would ask them questions. For example, they would say things like, should we go to war today or not? And the prophets would sometimes, you know, say, yes, go to war, for this battle will be given into your hand, that kind of thing. And there are really funny stories, actually, in Kings. Once the king of Israel and Judah were both going to war, and they called on 400 prophets, or these court prophets. And they were all dancing. I guess they danced to get their answers or whatever, and singing, and they were saying, yes, go to war, because the battle's in your hand. And one of the kings gets kind of nervous and says, isn't there somebody else we can consult?
And so, second opinion.
Right. And so finally they got this guy named Micaiah ben Imlah, and actually the king of Israel says, yeah, there's one other guy, his name's Micaiah, but I don't like him because he never says anything good about me. So they get Micaiah in, and it's funny because then Micaiah starts joining everybody else. He says, yeah, go to war, and the king of Israel says, no, oh, wait a minute, what do you really think? And he says, sure, go to war, you'll lose. And this was just a mess. This was just a way that God had. He put a lying spirit in the prophets, and so you'd get killed. So go ahead, go to war. He does, and he gets killed. But anyway, so this kind of court prophet was often a yes man, and was hired by the king, right? So
why don't we look at Joseph as a prophet?
Joseph as a prophet. Yeah, Joseph is an interesting case because he's a dreamer. He does most of his predicting or whatever through dreams, correct?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And while some of the prophets do have dreams, it doesn't seem their prophetic status doesn't seem to rely only on their dreams. And not only on telling the future through dreams, but they seem to have more of a moral component. They seem to be more interested in justice, you know, and changing the people's way of life and changing their hearts and aligning it more to the will of God. Joseph does have dreams, and he can tell the future with his dreams, but his dreams are usually ethically neutral, I would say. You know, well, there's going to be a famine. Oh, we should plan for the famine. Okay, you know, that kind of thing. Or, oh, well, your life will be spared. Well, I'm sorry, you're going to die. You know, he knows those kind of things. But he isn't really calling to the people and giving them God's perspective on the human situation. But good point. The prophets do have dreams. That's true. Mm-hmm. So that was one. That's one kind of prophet that there was. And actually, the court prophets. Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in the category or vocation or occupation of prophet.
Mm-hmm.
In our time, most folk we would confer the title of prophet on do not assume it to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Very few people go around saying, I'm a prophet.
Mm-hmm.
And if they do, we tend to call them false prophets.
Mm-hmm.
But in these times, apparently there was a class,
mm-hmm.
and even a school,
mm-hmm.
that people could go to become a prophet,
mm-hmm.
like right. Becoming a seminarian or something today. Is there a difference in our time and in that time in the understanding of the term prophet?
Yeah.
So is Amos really saying, I'm not one of those professional
prophets? I'm not one of those
professionals.
Prophets, mm-hmm.
But there are some who are. Or is he saying, the role of prophet is one that others will have to apply to me. I'm not going to take it on to myself.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on?
Well, it's interesting. He says, I am no prophet, nor a prophet's son.
Yeah.
Well, he says, but God called me out to prophesy, and that's the same root. So it's interesting. He says, I'm no prophet, nor a prophet's son, but God called me to prophesy. So he's claiming the verb, but not the noun, right? And that's what I started to go through, some of the different types of prophets that maybe he was reacting against. And so one is this court prophet idea, you know, the kind of the yes man, basically, that we obviously...
They're under a retainer.
Yeah, they earn their living. Mm-hmm.
And wouldn't that be the kind of the role that the rabbinical councils in Israel fulfill today? Or would they consider? I mean, do they consider that to be their role at all?
Well, the only thing is that in according to tradition, prophecy ceased.
Oh.
See, now we're dealing with written texts.
Rabbis are not prophets.
Rabbis are not prophets in any way. They're scholars,
they're
and they study the prophets.
Okay.
And they can derive good interpretations that you can apply to today from the prophets. But there are no prophets anymore, according to the Jewish understanding of things. And in fact, you know, once you start writing the stuff down, Amos is speaking. It's oral presentation, you know, direct. Once you start writing this stuff down, and once, you know, 200 BC or whatever, once you get a group of prophetic writings, well, those are the prophets. And so they are still valid in that they present a certain perspective on the world and give guidance and so forth, but it's through interpretation of them that you draw the prophetic tradition into the present.
But no more prophets now.
Yeah. Now some groups, I know there are some Christian charismatic groups. In fact, I had a woman in one of my classes last semester. She was from a group called the Vinland Church, and they had prophets in her group that spoke, you know, in sort of rapture states and so forth. Well, Mrs. Prophet up in Montana too. You mean you have you've heard of that, you know, going underground and so forth. So certain groups do think, yes, you know, we have prophets.
But there's something in the Bible that said that this is stopped at this point in time and there will be no more. I mean, it actually says
not necessarily says it. It says that Moses is the greatest of all prophets and that no one will ever be like Moses. Well, see, that's because the Torah is the most important part of the Jewish tradition. So you say, this is unlike anything else that will ever come. But it doesn't necessarily say there are no prophets anymore. It's just that through the process of writing them down and through the process of making a book collection of books, you change the whole nature of what prophecy is all about. It ceases to be.
Sure, and then sometimes even in a congregation, someone may have a word of prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something that is laid upon that person's heart that needs to be shared with the fellowship of believers. So there is prophecy even today. But, you know, to say that there are prophets in the Old Testament context, you know, probably not.
So we probably would still use that term prophet to apply to people who seem particularly able to express the divine perspective or, you know, the timely word for the community. But I don't know, probably most of us would. I don't know, does anybody know any prophets?
We usually confer the status on people after their death.
After their death.
Like Martin Luther King today is revered as a prophet, but when he was alive, a lot of people disputed that.
Usually he has no credentials, does he?
The prophet?
Yeah, at the time.
But a court prophet would be like Ronald and Nancy Reagan's astrologer.
Astrologer, yeah, there you
That's
go.
That's right.
I have to point out that there are some court prophets during that time with integrity. For example, you have to think of Nathan in correspondence with David. And Nathan was a court prophet. He was always hanging around. You know, he was the one who anointed him and everything like that. So they had a role even in establishing, you know, who would be king. But also he confronted him.
Spoke a discouraging word.
Mm-hmm. So Bathsheba.
No, I'm thinking of that Easter hymn we talk about Jesus as our prophet.
Right, that's definitely one of the claims that the Gospels are making about Jesus, that he is one of the prophets. And in fact, Matthew, you know, has Jesus in the Transfiguration on the mountain there with Moses and Elijah. And in the Torah it says, you know, there will be no other prophet like Moses. But another thing it says in Deuteronomy then is, I am sending you another prophet like me, or I'm sending another one like me. And then usually if you just read the story straight through, you think, okay, it's Joshua, you know, who will take up the leadership. But they're saying that to Jesus in that context, that Jesus is the one like Moses, in fact, even, you know, greater than Moses, appears with Moses on the mountain. So, good point. So court prophets, some people think there's also, and they would make their living, they would earn their bread. That's what it says here, you know, go earn your bread in Judah. So these are all groups apparently that made their living as prophets. A court prophet, cult prophets, prophets that had associations with temples and shrines, not cult like in the sense that we, you know, a little splinter group, but cult having to do with the ritual sacrifices and sort of the temple practices and so forth. So what a person would do in that culture is they'd go and they'd bring their sheep or whatever and sacrifice it, and then the official would come and say, your sacrifice has been accepted, your prayer has been answered, or whatever. So it would give kind of an oracle or a prophetic word at that particular moment. So there were probably cult prophets. There were clairvoyants. It's just simple clairvoyants, sometimes known as seers. And they also earned a living. It's kind of interesting. Samuel is one of these. Saul loses his donkeys, and he's looking around for his donkeys. This is before he's king. He loses his donkeys. Eventually he gains a kingdom through the whole search. But he loses his donkeys, and finally he says to his companion, look, let's go up there on that hill. There's a fellow up there, a seer up there. We can ask him where the donkeys are. So they go up there, and his friend says, but we don't have anything to bring him. You know, we don't have any food or any feed, you know. And so they find something. And so what Samuel does is tells them where the donkeys are, and then they pay him. So this is another type of sort of prophet or seer. And then finally, there were these prophetic bands, groups of people usually led by one charismatic figure. For example, Elijah and Elisha functioned this way, and they had a large groups of prophets, or sons of the prophets, it says, you know, that would follow them around, and they would do music, and sometimes they would gash themselves, kind of go into a frenzy, and these were really considered quite crazy, actually, not always respected.
Hippies?
Mm-hmm. Hippies, could be.
Well, women, again, you know, what was in the hem of a certain prophetess in the temple?
There were women prophet. There were prophetesses. Hulda was one example. This is during Josiah's time, around 622 or so. King Josiah is credited with a big reform in the temple. And what happened was he was doing a little repair of the temple, and they found all these scrolls, according to the story, and they didn't know how to interpret them. So they said, let's take these to Huldah and see what she has to say about them. So they took them to Huldah, and she told them, you better shape up the national, you know, religion here. And so that's exactly what they did. So yeah, there are prophetesses. Mm-hmm. She apparently, I mean, it looked like she was associated with the temple because, you know, they took them to her. So these are just to give you a little bit of background of sort of the types of prophets that came before. And Amos is distancing himself, at least from some of these, that apparently made their living by prophesying. So he is at least saying, look, I'm not doing this for money. You know, I'm not set up by the CIA from Judah to come up here. You know, I'm doing this because I have this call or whatever to come up and speak the truth.
Was it assumed to be an inherited tradition, the son of a prophet?
Mm. Well, in the case of Elijah and Elisha, in this prophetic band kind of tradition, you remember Elijah's going to be whisked off in the whirlwind, and Elisha asks him if only he could sort of follow in his footsteps, and Elijah says, well, if you can see me going up, then okay, fine, you can follow my footsteps, and he gives him his mantle also, which seems to be kind of a sign of investing him in authority. And so they go across the Jordan together, and Elijah parts the water, and they go on, and Elisha does see him taken up in the whirlwind. So when Elisha comes back, he takes the mantle and he hits the water and it parts. So that authority, that's one story of kind of a authority passing down, but it wasn't necessarily his genetic son, so it wasn't necessarily hereditary. So.
Yeah, so the, and another thing with prophets is they were blessed with signs and wonders. You know, they were able to do some pretty miraculous things.
Now that's an interesting point, because you do have Elijah and Elisha doing some remarkable things, and in fact, a lot of things remind you of the stories of Jesus, right? They feed big groups of people. They raise widows' sons from the dead.
Or the famine in the land, and they were able to, you know, I forget what it was, but she was starving with her child, and mm-hmm. the food miraculously was provided for mm-hmm. them during that time.
Mm-hmm. There's even a resurrection when they're burying Elisha. Some a dead corpse touches Elisha's body and climbs out of the grave. Which is kind of interesting. So there are a lot of miracles associated with these guys. But it's interesting, when you look at the classical prophets, the prophets whose words we have, very few miracles. Amos, why don't you, if you have time, you know, read through Amos. Don't get too discouraged if you can't understand, because it is poetry and references to things that, you know, scholars are debating what it means. So read it more, you know, skim it, kind of. But ask yourself, does Amos ever do any miracles? No. None of the classical prophets does any miracles, except maybe Isaiah. He's credited with curing King Hezekiah, who's on his deathbed. And also, as a sign, he makes the shadow move back. Instead of forward, he makes the shadow move back. So Isaiah is really the only one who does a miracle. So that's kind of interesting. In the classical prophets, you really have prophets that are concentrating on sort of the ethical side of things, and also against idolatry and so forth. But they aren't miracle workers in that sense that Elijah and Elisha are. Are there any other final remarks? We're going to have to end at this point, and we'll get back together tomorrow. We'll look at some of the other passages in Amos that are particularly, you know, good and insightful. It's said that he's very witty, and it's said that those who admire the poetry of Amos are admiring the pearls in the hilt in the sword in your chest. That's right to you. So, see you tomorrow. You might want to read Amos, if you can, 1 through 6. You might want to read the whole thing. It's only 9 chapters, so... Thank you.